The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Monday, February 24th, 2020, from Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and Bernie Sanders is in the driver's seat. I just can't decide if it's a Prius or a Duesenberg. It's a rambling, unwieldy jalopy, but it's big enough to fit all manner of Democrat, socialist, and political revolutionary, also some never-Trumpers. After getting almost half the vote in the fractured caucus in Las Vegas, 538 has Sanders as the most likely candidate to win the nomination. I am going to call him the odds-on favorite. Thus far, I've been reluctant to do so. Why? Well, here's why. The prediction markets have him right now as a 60% favorite to win the nomination. I saw it as high as 67% a day or two ago. That's just a data point and a data point about perception, but there it is. I take 538's numbers to heart. They're not gospel, but they're very good. And they say Sanders has a 46% chance of winning the nomination. In second place is no one with 40%. And what they mean is locking up enough delegates before the convention. But let's look at that 40%. There is more than a 10, 20, even 30% chance that of that 40% chance, let's say it is true that there's a quite likely outcome that no one wins the nomination on the first ballot, the person with maybe the best chance to win it eventually will be the person who has the plurality of delegates, which 538 is telling us will be Bernie Sanders. What I'm saying is, add Sanders' 46% chance to whatever fraction of the 40% he represents, he's over 50%. He is more likely than not to win the nomination. That all said, let me also say a few things that are true. These are things that are true. Even if the big Bernie fans, I don't want to diminish them with the sobriquet Bernie Bros, but the most vocal and impassioned Sanders supporters don't like me saying it. One true thing, caucuses are bad. They're bad for democracy. They're a bad way to count votes. Now they have three public steps, each one a new chance to screw up. You might not have been paying as close attention to Nevada as to Iowa, but results are slow coming in. They're contested, and it seems that there are a lot of internal inconsistencies. I mean, if Iowa was a 10 out of 10 in expectations and an F for execution, Nevada was a 6 out of 10 in expectations and probably a D plus or a C minus in execution. There's no secret ballot. It's too time consuming. Iowa should go. Nevada should go. Caucuses should go. Two, you can't win a state in a proportional contest. Well, I guess you could if you got almost 100% of the vote and all the delegates. But I said this after every vote in 2016. I'll say it again now just because it's true. No one won Nevada. No one won Iowa. No one won New Hampshire. No one's going to win South Carolina. They're going to win delegates in proportion, roughly, to their vote totals in these states. And why that's important is, after winning all these states, someone might be surprised, huh, how come he isn't further along to the nomination? Or after winning state after state after state. In fact, possibly after never losing a state, how could he not have won the nomination? Because no one's winning states. They're winning proportions of the delegates in each state. And three, you're not going to like this one. Bernie Sanders is undervetted. Wait, what? We all know what he does, what he says, that he's never changed. How is he undervetted? I'm not talking about when he returned from Yaroslavl in 1988. I'm talking about things like his belief in MMT. I think he believes in MMT. He never says he doesn't. And his economic advisor, Stephanie Kelton, is America's main proponent of modern monetary theory. I will say, before he's elected, if all informed Americans or quasi-informed Americans don't have an opinion on MMT, that will be political malpractice. I'm working on a piece or a spiel that will give you an informed opinion. But if this doesn't happen during the primary, and it is up to the Republicans to define MMT during the general, it's not going to be helpful for Sanders. For the record, modern monetary theory aside, state after state is feeling the burn. And Bernie drives the Stutz Bearcat all the way down south tomorrow for the South Carolina debate in advance of the vote there on Saturday. The collective inaction of his fellow Democrats will be the subject of my spiel. But first, Toure, broadcaster and writer, and now podcaster. I've known Toure since we were both in college together. And oh, did he spit fire on the pages of the Emory Wheel. Want to know the name of his column? 40 Acres in a Pen. That is a good name for a column. And now, he is the host of a show with another good name. The host of Ture Show, it's Dick Cavett. No, it's Ture.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cases solved using forensic genealogy. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about this remarkable new crime-solving tool, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing it. I include input from law enforcement to give you the inside scoop that we all crave with a straightforward, no-nonsense delivery. You can find DNA ID on any podcast platform. Episodes come out weekly on Mondays.
Ture is here. He is a journalist and a critic. You may have remembered him from MSNBC. And now he has a podcast that I've been listening to, dropping in on, sort of eavesdropping. Ture Show, no articles here, definite or indefinite. Hey, Ture, how are you?
I appreciate you for noticing it's Ture Show and not the Ture Show.
It's just Ture Show.
Very nice. I think it was slightly inspired by Chappelle's Show, mm-hmm. right? No articles.
Yeah.
Just Chappelle's
Although
show.
Alphabetically, if they count the, it's not too far off from Ture Show. So if people went to find the Ture Show, it would be there.
No,
anyway. It would
still be there. But yes. No, I wanted no articles. Just get right to it.
I was waiting for you to have a podcast. You're a really good interviewer. It was going to come around one day.
Thank you. What's
the idea between how you book guests and what you want to talk about?
Well, we try to talk about success. I wanted to talk to really interesting, mostly black people, not always black people. We've had a lot of great white people, some great Asian folks, Latino folks, but Latinx folks. But like, you know, really focusing on black people who are successful in some field, be it mm-hmm. entertainment or sports or maybe business or politics, and try to get at who you are and how you became successful and what you know as a master of some area that can help other people say, oh, that's how you do it. So when I talk to Amy Sherald, I want other painters
She's
who are coming
up. She's Michelle Obama's portraitist.
Yes. I want other painters to go, okay, this was a really interesting discussion of how to be a painter, which will maybe help me get from being a low to mid-level painter to a higher level painter. Or when I talk to Taraji P. Henson, or we just did one with Russell Hornsby or another actor.
Billy Porter was a good one.
Billy Porter.
Yeah.
How do I get from being a beginner or a low-level actor to a higher-level actor to understand the craft and the business of it? So, I mean, like, just you've become successful. What did you do right that other people can build off of?
Now, with Amy Sherald, that was an interesting conversation because I got the feeling so much of her genius is intuitive and instinctive. And then she has been asked over the years, well, explain it in a way that isn't visual, explain it in a way that makes sense to the ears. And I know this from working in sports a long time. Sometimes you ask an athlete, you know, how do you do it? And they don't really know. So she has been asked it many times over the years, and she developed an answer. But I'm not sure. It seemed like she was kind of trying out her answer and saying it could be this, but I can't really say exactly where it comes from, such is the nature of the work I do.
I mean, you know, she was brilliant, and just sort of talking to her about how she does her thing was really interesting. And sometimes it's just about not asking people questions, but presenting observations about what they do and then letting them respond to that.
Right.
Sometimes I feel like as questioners, we make a statement and then at the tail, you ask a question which changes the direction of the conversation mm-hmm. and makes it easier or impossible to answer.
And right, because like, they have to always react to that last tail of a question when that maybe wasn't your intent.
Yes, yeah. And if you just pose the observation, Amy Sherald, your color choices are amazing and they're bold and vibrant. And I feel like you could erase the figures. You're a portraitist, but you could erase the figures and just do abstract color fields. And I would be so fascinated.
Yeah.
There's no question there. But I've just made this observation that is hopefully compelling to her. I have had a couple of people throughout my career say, is there a question here? And I'm like, work with me here. Like, we're doing an interview.
But not on this show. Or if they say that, they cut it out. Because I think they're excited to be there.
We very, very rarely edit. I would struggle to think of things that we edited out. There have been a couple, but not in a long, long time. We really go for, like, to put 100% of the tape on the air.
Well, half your life is an interviewer or some significant portion, and half your life is an opinion giver, a person who is paid to tell us what you think. It's been about, 9 years since you wrote the book on post-blackness?
Something like that.
Yeah. And so since then, I mean, things have changed a lot. So the title was Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. Mm. How has what your answer was then, how has that changed from 2011 to 2020?
Well, what I was talking about in that book was the complexity of blackness, how we're not monolithic. I think that the notion that we're not monolithic is still clear.
Yeah.
I think that given the era of Trump and my own personal, more deeper understanding of something like, you know, mass incarceration, Black Lives Matter issues, you know, the police violence epidemic that we have been going through. If I had to do over in terms of writing a survey of what it means to be black, it would be a much different book. It would deal less with identity and more with more concrete issues of survival, of spiritual and physical survival.
Well, do you think it's because then in 2011 we had the space, we took a breath, pretty in the middle of the Obama presidency?
Yeah, absolutely.
We had the ability to sort of say, not just black people, all people, okay, we're not currently under assault. Let's really tease out what our identities are.
It seemed that way.
Our identities have kind of been compressed by the Trump administration.
I mean, in the second Obama term, the sort of infamous tragic killings sort of rose up, right? Black Lives Matter rises up. The new Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander's amazing book, really educates a lot of people on the whole game as it's being played. Patrice and Opal and Licia and DeRay are like educating people on how the game is being played. You know, Obama and them are open to it. All of that alone would say to me, like, you have to say something different than an identity statement of like, we are more complex. I mean, I was responding really to Obama being elected and then saying, okay, so, I mean, even like the night before Iowa, saying America's ready for, in 2008, saying America's ready for a black president, even like black political scientists would have laughed you out of the room.
Yes.
So we were all wrong. So what else are we wrong about around race? Now, noticing like some things have changed and some things have not. And I was certainly not saying we are post-racial, that post-blackness is entirely different than post-racial. And now it seems almost like we're going back to narratives of pain and trauma and, you know, repression and hate crimes that like our parents would be like, this feels like the 50s again. And like for Trump, it's like, yeah, that's what I was talking about. I mean, you know, the last few months on MSNBC, I was like, when he says make America great again, what is he talking about? What era is he throwing back to? And I think now we can see it was like the 50s and like, you know, where the white man is fully in control and things are pretty bad for black men and for women in general. And so you would really have to address that much more. And I would have to deal with much more with like what Michelle Alexander was talking about in her book. And I would write something entirely different.
Do you think that the notion that has taken hold and largely been embraced of a white supremacy and we live in a white supremacist society, is that the best way to look at it, a good way to look at it, a way that properly addresses and speaks to the experience of most black people?
That we're in a white supremacist society?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak for most black people, of course, but I mean,
after you just got done telling me about the monolith, yes.
Well, right. But I mean, you know, look, I think a lot of us have been clear that it's a white supremacist country. it was that when Obama was elected. That was not, it's not like we took an 8-year break from that.
Right.
One singular black man was allowed to drive the gigantic spaceship that still perpetuates white supremacy.
Sure.
He tried in his own way to make some changes to it, but it's not going to be changed by one president.
No.
And there's ways that his blackness keep him from being able to make some of the changes that we need. I feel like the single thing that is most damaging to black America is the war on drugs, right? And mm-hmm. and all the things that it leads to in terms of the over-policing, the over-incarceration, you know, the over-penalizing of black and brown people for using and selling drugs, and white people are using and selling drugs at similar rates. And the only way to end the underground market for drugs is to have a legal market, right? Because if there's a legal market, then the math for the underground market doesn't make sense anymore, right? If they lose a significant portion, even 25% of their business, it no longer makes sense to risk your life and risk lots of money trying to get drugs in from Mexico or Canada.
If you do it in a somewhat competent way, because Colorado, there's still this underground market, even though it's legal because of the way they've screwed up the regulation to some extent.
I imagine it will take time. For it to collapse.
No, but stipulate. What you're saying is the only way to get past it is to legalize.
Yeah. And can the black president be the first one to push through legalization? No, he can't. Especially not when he spends all his political capital trying to get health care and save the banks.
Yes.
And there's a Republican Congress that's like, we're going to make sure you accomplish nothing.
Right. When he was, all of his pro-black agenda was always had to be sold as, couched in, but also it was literally true. This is helping everyone.
Yeah.
Will it help black people? He would go on and say, yes. And in fact, it'll help black people a lot. And the ACA is going to be great for black people, but it's not just for black people. And he would always get criticized by some vanguard of the intellectual left. But think about the politics of it. It's impractical for Barack Obama to say, and now here is my reparations program.
Yeah, Barack Obama's not going to be able to.
I don't think he even believes it, by the way. Yes.
Reparations. I would write a different book now. I mean, it almost, you know, it's almost like you find the book, mm-hmm. right? And like you would write a different book at one point in your life or one point in history than you would at another time. And if I had another crack at it. Not that I disavowed that book. I'm still proud of that book. Not necessarily of all the books I've written, but that one I'm still proud of. But I'm working on something that I think will be pretty epic, if I do say so myself.
Tell me.
I'm doing a seven-hour podcast about Prince.
Oh.
We'll deal in depth with his life and who he was as a person, as a lover, as a musician, his youth, his influences, his work ethic, his work process. I've talked to a ton of people about, like, all insiders in his life. People from the Revolution, people who grew up around him, girlfriends, photographers, stylists, engineers, you know, all kinds of music, people from the New Power Generation, all kinds of people from different eras of life about who he was. And I mean, like, I wrote a book about Prince.
Yeah.
I've interviewed him. I've written a lot about him. And I've learned a ton in the creating of this thing. So I think that's going to be pretty exciting.
How do you find out how he was as a lover?
You talk to people.
And they are honest with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're not trying to elevate their experience because it was with Prince? Like, who is really emboldened and said, yeah, it was okay. I've had better.
People were very honest about all of it. I mean, like, if you get a similar answer from multiple people, you can tell, oh, this seems to be true and keeps getting repeated over and over. I mean, and there's some epic stories about him that we're able to tell as well. That's a lot of fun.
Touré is the man, in fact, the titular man behind Touré's show. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll be looking out for that big Prince. When's that going to drop? The Prince series.
Later this year, not too far from now. It's about 90% done. I got a couple more interviews to do, a couple more edits to do, but we're getting there.
All right. He takes you in the music room and in the bedroom with Prince. Thank you so much, Touré.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. Tomorrow is a huge debate in South Carolina, or maybe just a huge spectacle that does not have the possibility of rewriting that which is faded. Of course, in this campaign, rewrites aren't hard to come by, like this example of a very public type of editor's note, as reported by Youngstown WFMJ Channel 21.
Just hours after opening the downtown Youngstown field office for Mike Bloomberg's presidential campaign, it was defaced. Caution tape littered the trees, plyboard signs saying stop and frisk, an oligarchy.
Couple things. The sign, which I showed right there on the screen, did not say oligarchy. It said oligarch, a more pointed critique of the man who embodies the system rather than a vague critique of the system itself. Maybe not even a critique, maybe just a word. The vocab word of the day that these protesters wanted us all to know. You know, you'd write oligarch or say oligarch at Michael Bloomberg. Sort of like if you wanted to insult Bernie Sanders, you'd call him a communist. You wouldn't call him a communism. But there's a bigger issue here, and it's all about the defacedness of the property involved. Defaced. The signs were spray painted, but not spray painted on the actual building. They were spray painted on what looks like sheets of plywood, and leaned against the building. They were propped up against the building at a, very pleasant and flattering 30-degree angle. The face of the building is still the face. It was not defaced. The Youngstown Bloomberg HQ wasn't defaced. It was, if anything, accessorized. Now, some other Bloomberg offices were more conventionally defaced, which sort of comes with the territory. Another Ohio Bloomberg field office had the sign $1 billion for $1 billion, I think, glued to it. And next to that slogan was the slogan, broken windows, broken homes. But that was glued to a window, and the window wasn't broken. And you know that the people posting the sign had to have thought of it. I mean, it's right there in the name of the sign. So remarkable restraint. By the way, to some extent, the signs are a little self-defeating. The Intercept accused Michael Bloomberg of running a Stasi-style police. Stasi-style police and surveillance operations. Obviously, as these defacers remain at large, the Stasi-style tactics didn't extend to, I don't know, buying a Simply Safe and a Ring with monitoring for the front door. By the way, the Stasi, you know them, they were the East German police. They arrested 250,000 dissidents. Bloomberg's supposed Stasi-style monitoring of Muslims yielded precisely zero criminal charges, which argues it was more Mayberry tactics with a little mix of constitutional violation. But Mike Bloomberg doesn't need me to defend him. First of all, I can't, not completely. Second of all, he apparently has an army of meme monkeys at his disposal. Tank Sinatra and At Cal Salad and At the Funny Introvert. They're all pushing out wackadoo Bloomberg whimsy. To quote a wise man,
God help us.
A week ago, Michael Bloomberg was rising in the polls and seen as one of the more centrist candidates who could knock Bernie Sanders off his perch. Then the rest of the field put bars of soap into their towels and flailed at his body for 90 minutes straight in the great Democratic blanket party of 2020. Tomorrow, they will get another chance to either beat down Bloomberg or smack down Sanders. Last time around, Bloomberg was tantalizingly dangling from the ceiling like a multicolor cray paper burro at a 9-year-old's birthday party. And all the other candidates just knew there were tons of votes inside as they smacked it over and over again with their sticks. Now, the conventional wisdom said this was unwise, said that the more moderate Dems should have known that Bernie Sanders was the opponent and that Bernie was the man at the top, not Bloomberg. Bad strategy, said the conventional wisdom. Except, all right, one, Bloomberg and Buttigieg both very much tried to knock Bernie. Biden hit Bernie a bit, hit Bloomberg a bit, but petered out at the end and needed a blankie. Then Klobuchar, I sense she turned to her right and wanted to lay into Bernie, but there, right there, her vision of Bernie was blotted out by the boyish insouciance, Mayor de Blasio would say smugness, of Pete Buttigieg. And Klobuchar could not take it.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
No, Senator Klobuchar, I know not to downplay the revolutionary power of women's anger. I have red traced her. I got the drill. But we now have accounted for every Democrat on the stage, why they didn't attack Bernie, Every Democrat except one, Elizabeth Warren. And if there was ever a candidate who very much needs Sanders to fade in order to rise, it is Elizabeth Warren. They occupy the same lane as the thinking goes, the thinking being the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is what we're debunking here. Take that in stride. But here's the thing. Elizabeth Warren agrees with Bernie Sanders more than anyone who's left in the race. And Elizabeth Warren pretty much got into public life to go after the activities of guys like Mike Bloomberg, or specifically Mike Bloomberg. Taking it to Michael Bloomberg is what Elizabeth Warren was born to do. It makes her feel most alive. So when we think about the last debate, picture instead of six candidates up there, half a dozen podiums. Let's recast this podia. I don't know. We have six podia still, but we have three salmon, a Kodiak bear, a cobra, and a mongoose. Now, everyone should logically fear the bear. The bear is the apex predator. If you don't team up on the bear, you are going to lose. Even the mongoose knows she's got to fear the bear. But she's a mongoose. Sure, the bear is above her on the food chain. Oh, but the cobra. Look at the cobra. She's a mongoose. You're a cobra. How do you not go after the cobra? And then she gets him. She gets the cobra. She gets him to say, I don't know, maybe some field mouse thought I made a bad hiss at them over the years. And she wins. She defangs the cobra. And it puts a lot of cash in her coffers and pep in her step. And a few days later, she was still reveling in a successful attack.
About a threat that is coming our way. And it's a big threat. Not a tall one, but a big one. Michael Bloomberg.
That is halfway between Trumpian and triumphant. So if Elizabeth Warren isn't going to attack Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden is a bit too scattered to attack Bernie Sanders and Buttigieg and Klobuchar are fouling out early in a low-scoring Big Ten affair, well, how is Bernie Sanders going to be stopped? Answer, he's probably not. Then again, if he was, he'd be stopped by now. There doesn't seem to be any great argument that will confuse and derail Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has an answer for everything that comes his way. I have heard claim that Bernie Sanders is susceptible to the charge of coziness, or at least lack of hostility to the gun industry. Yet Bernie Sanders has been batting away that charge since Hillary Clinton lobbed it his way, I don't know, 35 times during the last primary. The "you're a socialist" critique gets met with, yeah, I know, and here's what that means. Let me define it for you. Pretty much FDR. I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but it's more accurate than this.
We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work. Whoa.
And if that gets not just Bernie Sanders going, oh, no, you didn't, but I heard two or three people, oh, knowing, I think calling the guy a socialist is not going to stop him. Bloomberg, or maybe Klobuchar, can go after him for the sexual harassment with his 2016 campaign. But that is well known, and it hasn't really hurt Bernie yet. This idea that there is a way, any way, to discredit Bernie Sanders with a jab or an accusation or a critique, it just seems wrong. Bernie is now an idea that enough Democrats have gotten behind that it seems very hard to derail. And that's it for today's show. Priscilla Lobby produces The Gist. She meant to criticize Bernie Sanders, but was laughing too hard at those dank memes, and she totes forgot. Daniel Schrader is The Gist's producer. He was going to stick at Sanders, but there was something about his affect and demeanor. It reminded Daniel of his grandpa. Well, not his grandpa. Daniel's not a Jew who grew up in Bialystok and lived in the shtetl, but, you know, there's probably some grandfather who did. The Gist. We were so going to take down Bernie Sanders. But Tom Steyer, how is no one saying anything about this guy's tie? Oom-peru-da-peru-do-peru, and thanks for listening.